Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 18, delivered on October 20, 2009. The title of this lecture is Weighted Average Cost of Capital.
Today, weighted average cost of capital. Now, when I do the actual math, you will find that it is relatively easy, straightforward, formula-driven. Just know what formula to use where, and to some extent, why. But before I begin, I point out that cost of capital has two parts, weighted average cost of capital and marginal cost of capital. Now, let me take you back to your dark days in economics, in microeconomics. And I do recognize that because you did not have me as your teacher of economics, you didn't have the best. So I'll try to bring you up to speed, but I'm sure you remember this stuff like it happened yesterday anyway, or not. If you remember in economics, okay, let me say this. Marginals are far more important than averages because economic decision making, whether it is by the consumer or by the firm, is based upon the last or the next, not upon the average, not upon the history, not upon feelings and sentiments. Rational behavior is based upon what happens last. And if you recall in economics, many things had a curious behavior of either diminishing or increasing. So, for example, we had the law of diminishing marginal utility. Although your total utility would go up, let me try this. Have you ever had sex?
Sure.
I'm with you. Now, your first sex of the night. Your joy meter, in economics we call it utility. Your joy meter goes to 1,000 and rings the bell. So you decide, well, I rang the bell once, so we ring the bell again, and your total joy, your total utility, goes to 1,900. And the candy bar sign lights up. I don't know what the hell that meant. So you say 3. And your joy meter goes up some more. Total joy. Made it 2,700. You see how it's going up, but it's going up in smaller increments. By the time you get to the 20th, that joy meter ain't banging the gong. It's damn woman. Leave me alone. Go get a pizza. Come back next week with it. You see, although your total joy is going up, it's going up less and less and less. The law of diminishing marginal utility. Real economics for real people. Marginal cost works the same way. Total cost might be going down, or it might be going up, we don't know. But the marginal cost is going up. When you go from, have you ever done push-ups?
Yep.
Okay, when you go from 1 to 2 push-ups, your second push-up is a 100% increase in your output of push-ups from 1 to 2. That's not bad. Okay, let's talk about going from 100 to 101. That's a 1% increase. But if you're like normal human beings, that 101st one, you sound like you've got constipation. And the service, 101 drill sergeant. Isn't that the way it is? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You ever gone running?
first couple of blocks.
Man, I feel good. You hear the Rocky music in the background. Ba, 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 ba. By the time you get down about 20 blocks, go out on the streets out around the rich communities where you see the yuppies trying to jog. They look so sad. You know, they're running along. Their arms are flopping like this. You know, I feel like I've got a very loud horn, just honking it to kill them, just to put them out of their misery.
Harder and harder. Cost is going up. The amount of input for a given percentage output is increasing.
The law of increasing marginal cost. Cost will go up at the margin. It will not stop going up. It will go up forever. That's why, if you remember, in economics, we drew, or I hope your professor drew the marginal cost curve with that highly characteristic J hook. It steamed upward. Once that thing started going up, it never stopped going up. That is the reality of business. It's not just a theory. I've run businesses. I've consulted for businesses. I have taught from actual business data. Marginal cost, the cost of the last unit produced, will go up. But here's an interesting thing about it. Average cost. You see, marginal cost is actually not that easy to calculate. To be straight with you, it's something that we certainly would want you to know how to do, or at least to estimate in a managerial science course or a managerial accounting or a managerial finance course. But it's not something that we are going to have an easy time with. More likely, it's easy, and also it's more likely to be interesting to someone else who's in business to talk about unit cost, average cost, than it would be to talk about marginal cost. Even though marginal cost is going to be the important one for decision making, we would be more likely to talk about, well, the unit cost of production right now, we're at 1,400 units, the unit cost of production, than to talk about an average cost. Now, average cost actually is being driven by marginal cost. The shape of the average cost curve is being driven by marginal cost. Look, think about this. I have given you all a test, and I've put them all together, worked, done the grading, and I've put all the grades in the book. I've gotten the average, and the average comes out to be a 70%. No, a 70%. You actually pulled a 70%, which is more than a 70%, which is admirable on that last test. Pisses me off. Okay, here we go. But, okay, I've got the average. And then a new student comes in. Hello, sir. Who the hell are you? I just registered. You registered now? Yes, sir. Okay, fine. You have to take a test. Where are you from? Decatur, sir. Oh, he's going to smoke that curve for us, isn't he? Uh-huh. Decatur. I've got to stop Decatur. I get students unhappy with that. My mom is from Decatur. Yes, I know. I saw her at a truck stop there. I shouldn't do that. Yes, I should. Look, he gets a 30 on the exam. Just valedictorian. And what is that going? So I have to recalculate the average. That last score, that marginal score, was below the average. So what will it do when I put it in and recalculate the average? It will pull it down, 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 down the ring of fire. This cost, this one right here, the average was here. When I stick that last score in, if it's below the average, it's going to haul the average down. And another student comes in. Oh, I've just read. Oh, you. Oh my God. Where are you from? Pontiac. Okay. So he gets a 45. And when I put that into the average is still, let's say, about 65. When I throw in a 45 and do the average again, what's it going to do to the average? It's going to pull it down. See, as long as marginal cost is below average,
It will pull the average down. This isn't really an economics concept, a finance concept. This is just a mathematical thing, a statistics thing. So finally someone comes in, the average has dropped down to a 64, no, let's say to a 60. So here comes someone in, where are you from? U-High. Aces the exam with a 60%, exactly the average. So when I put this one in and recalculate the average was a 60%. I throw another exam in, recalculate the average. When that last exam is a 60%, what will it do to the average? It won't do anything. It'll stop. So in other words, but when I get to the point where the last is the same as the average stops dropping, bottoms out. In calculus, we say that the first derivative gets to zero. The slope of the tangent line is zero. And then we start talking about, okay, what happens if the last is above the average? Okay, we get someone who comes in from some fancy private school. Well, he's going to be above the average. So when I throw his in, and the average is below the one that I just threw in, what is it going to do to the average? Yeah, it's going to pull it up. And every time there's one above the average, it's going to pull the average up. And so that's why you see this curious relationship of average cost curves and marginal cost curves. They're shaped, the average cost curve is shaped like a U. And as long as marginal cost is below average cost will fall. When marginal cost is above average cost will rise. And it will bottom out, the two will equal at the bottom of the average, because when the last is the same as the average, when you put the last into the average doesn't change. Was this the way it was explained to you when you took economics, how these curves were related, or was anything like this talked about at all? I'm getting an awful lot of blank looks here. Maybe it's you forgot it. But that's the best way to explain the relationship between a marginal cost and an average cost. Is that here. So why am I talking about this in a finance course? This isn't economics. Well, first, economics is a driving force behind finance. But more to the point of this lecture, when I'm talking in cost of capital, I am talking about two different thinking arrangements. One would be weighted average cost of capital. The other would be the marginal cost of capital. The marginal cost of capital would be what is going to be the cost of the capital the last time or the next time you hit the capital markets. So I could have my weighted average cost of capital fairly high. But if I can get capital in some way from some source below the weighted average cost, it's going to pull the weighted average cost down. At some point, though, if I tap it too many times, I'm going to find that my marginal cost of capital is very high, and it's going to start pulling up my weighted average cost of capital. So the business framework, the business decision-making framework we are looking at here is to try to minimize the weighted average cost of capital. And that's why we get into this thing that I had mentioned briefly before. If I were talking about, let's say, debt to total assets, the percentage of your total assets that is debt, not equity. So I was talking about debt to total assets here. If I have too little debt in my capital structure, I could actually increase the percentage of debt in my capital structure and lower my weighted average cost of capital. Similarly, though, if I have too much debt in my capital structure, I'd be crazy to tap the capital markets again for debt. It would be better if I went out and sold stock to pull down the ratio of debt to total assets. And that's one of the interesting things that we talk about, is finding optimal capital structure. It's all about minimizing our weighted average cost of capital. And that's why you will see that it is not always, well, we'll get debt this time, or we'll get stock this time. You are looking at what the overall weighted average cost of all of your sources of capital is. to get the idea of where what would be your best financing vehicle. Unfortunately, there's a little monkey wrench in this. Some of your cost of capital, you're married to it. You're kind of married to it. That's an unfortunate thing. And also, let me bring up one last thing about debt. Now, there's a statement at the beginning of the book, beginning of the chapter in the book, and I don't know how to take it. Oh, yes, I do. Bullshit. You can always get, if you have a great idea, you can always get capital. Yeah, if you want to sell your ass, yeah, maybe sell a kidney, maybe kill yourself so you can get the life insurance policy. It's not true. You can't always get money if you've got a great idea. That's horse crap. I saw a lot of companies with incredible products. They died because there was no way to find money unless they gave up the entire project. And sometimes they gave it up involuntarily by the oddest of circumstances. Funny how the IRS and the SEC tend to raid companies with brilliant ideas, and then those brilliant ideas show up later, years later, in big corporations. Never mind that. Debt can get very expensive. At first, debt can be very cheap. And for a long time, debt can be very cheap. But if you just keep borrowing and borrowing, there gets to be a point where risk of default begins to embed in the interest rates that capital sources would charge you. And so your debt will actually start going up in cost. And essentially it's this. Look, you're having to service more and more debt. Your time's interest earned is going to go down unless you really keep your revenues pumping. Your cost of unless your operating income stays pace, your time's interest earned is going to be slowly moving towards one. That gets to be scary. So lenders start putting more of a default premium into your debt. So your cost of debt starts rising. And that's that marginal cost doing that. Similarly, if you just keep selling stock, and you don't have the earnings to support that watering down of your stock, that dilution of your stock, increase the supply of anything, its price goes down. If its price goes down, the cost of it, the yield of it goes up. That's the rock solid rule of finance. So you see, you're in this sort of trap in all kinds of ways. You can't just say, I need money, well, I'll find some great source. Bull. Because no matter how you play it, you've got to think about, okay, if I tap these capital markets this way too much, okay, I'll have to shift over here. Oh, I've tapped these capital markets a lot too. Oh, I got to shift over here. No matter how you cut it, you are on an upward sloping marginal cost of capital curve. So let's go to the story now. These boards are so small, and that chalkboard, you can't wear black with use a chalkboard. Here we go. I'm going to just write it over here. This is a slightly large whiteboard. Okay. Here's the places you can get capital. One is through debt. The other place is through equity. Now, you can also get capital donations from your mom, maybe, but we'll set that one aside. So you're going to get it through debt or through equity. Now, debt is straightforward in terms of debt. Now, there are all kinds of varieties of debt, bills, notes, bonds, mortgage bonds, debentures, junior subordinated, whatever, but it's debt. Now, the equity is a little more complicated because there are more identifiable in terms of cost types of equity in terms of their claims. Now, remember the debt has the holders of debt, the bearers of debt have prior claim to the cash flows. They get theirs before anyone else. And if they don't get theirs, they will push your company out of business. So you have to pay the debt first. Always keep that in mind. And also remember the financial leverage. When you start paying interest after the EBIT line, if you pay interest after operating income, that creates more volatility. You remember that from the CV, the coefficient of variation. if you put in interest, the net income had more volatility than if you didn't put in the interest. There it is. That's that volatility. So why would we do debt? Well, because it's safer. It's got the prior claim on the cash flows. It gets its before any stockholder of any kind gets its. Now let's take the equity. Recognizing right away that equity will have a higher cost because it is a higher risk form of capital. An equity owner is going to expect more from a company than a debt holder will, simply because the equity owner is at greater risk. The equity owner doesn't get anything until the debt's paid off. Okay? So, recognizing that, we'll talk about equity. Now, over here, I'm going to put on the far left side, close to the debt, a kind of equity that is very similar to debt in some ways. It is preferred stock. Now, I get this impression in your textbook, they almost avoid talking about preferred like it's an equity. It is an equity. It's stock. But it's an oddball equity. Because in preferred stock, there is a par value stated. Now, this isn't like the trivial par values on common stock, a penny, tenths of a penny, or a hundredth of a penny. Sometimes common stock doesn't even have a par value anymore. No, preferred stock has serious par value, maybe $100 a share par. That's significant. And then there is a dividend, a preferred dividend stated in a percentage, and it will say, let's say, 4%. What that means is that you would take 4% of the par value, whatever the par value is. Some is, it could be anywhere. The par value could be 50, 80, 100, 1,000, 10,000, I don't know. But whatever that percentage is that you see, that would be multiplied by the par value, and that is what you would get as a check. So if I had a $100 par value, 4% preferred, that means that you would get, if for one share of preferred stock of this company, $4 every year forever. Forever. And you would get yours, if there's any money left at the bottom line, you get yours. And if you don't get yours 1 year, if it's cumulative preferred, you get yours and what you missed the last year. Before the stock, common stockholders get a dime, they can, before the directors can even talk about declaring a dividend for the common shareholders, they have to take care of the preferred shareholders. Preferred shareholders come first. Common shareholders suck hind tit on this. Oh, for God's sake, that's a farm term. God, it's hot in here. Preferred. So do you see how it's sort of like a bond? Because it's just like a coupon, except it goes on forever and ever. It's not as good as a bond because, obviously, the bondholders would have to have their interest paid first, and any maturity, any bonds that matured, the face value would have come first. So bondholders still have the prior claim. Preferred stock has a residual claim, but it is going to go on forever. You're going to get it. And the common shareholders don't get a thing until the preferred shareholders are satisfied. So it has that characteristic of a bond. And its pricing is very similar to a very simple bond. Now, two other kinds of equity. There is common equity. These two over here are common equity, common stock. One of them is the internally generated equity, and the other is the externally generated. Now, when I say internally generated, after the company has paid all of its bills and paid its debt holders their interest and anything else they have to pay them, and after the preferred has been paid, the common shareholders are standing there. You can give them a dividend, but that's not enough, you see, because
They own everything once everyone else has been paid. They own it. It's theirs. So you give them that dividend, that's not the extent of your obligation to them. The rest of the money that came down as net, your earnings, what you didn't give to them as dividends, that belongs to them. So you damn well better give them a return on what you do with that. When you plow that money back into the company, when you plow that mother back into the company, you had better show those shareholders that you care. That they can't do better with that money. Because if they can, they're going to sell your stock, drive your stock price down. And then when you go out here to get externally generated equity, new sales of common stock, you ain't going to get anything for it. So these cats hold all the cards in a way. Because even though they suck hind tit on this whole thing here, they are the ones who can make your life miserable. They can walk into the shareholders' meetings. Believe me, I was in that kind of a situation. And bitch at you. If they have majority control on the outside, they can fire your board of directors. And if nothing else, at the end of the day, they can simply vote with their feet, sell your stock, and drive your stock price into the ground. And then you won't find equity. You won't be able to sell a share of stock anywhere. You probably will even have a hard time getting anyone to lend you debt, capital too. So this is the layout. These are the component costs of capital. The component costs of capital. Now let's talk turkey here. Let me do a couple of them. Let's talk about debt. The cost of debt. Now the cost of debt here. And I'm going to put up a little numerical example here. Okay, let me go operating income, which I hope you will recall is EBIT, and then we'll take away the interest to get our EBT. Then we'll take away our taxes and we'll say let's have a tax rate of 30%. And that will give us our net income. But let's look at two different scenarios. Scenario one, operating income is $80,000, and in scenario two, it's $80,000. But in scenario one, the company has no debt outstanding. So there is no interest to pay. So EBT drops down as 80,000 minus zero, which is 80,000. In scenario two, In scenario two, the company does have debt in its capital structure, so it pays interest, and we'll say that the company pays $20,000 in interest. So EBT comes down as 80,000 minus 20,000, that's $60,000. Nothing hard so far. Now let's take taxes at 30% of EBT. Okay, so we'll have, on the first scenario, you're going to take $30,000 times $80,000, so that'll be $24,000. So our net income will be $80,000 minus $24,000, which is $56,000. In the second scenario, we have $60,000 of income exposed to taxes, to taxation, so we have 30% of $60,000. Is 18,000. Sorry, I had a brain glitch there. So 60,000 minus 18,000 is $42,000. So the difference in net income, here is, wait a minute, $14,000. But, wasn't scenario two $20,000 of interest? You see what's happened? Let me make sure you see that. Net is down 14,000, not 20,000. Well, how would I know what in the world is that? Ah, there's a tax shield. The interest that you pay is a tax shield. It shields. And the size of the tax shield, what's the size of that tax shield? See the tax shield there? The tax shield is 6,000 dollars. Wow. So how would you know what that tax shield is? It would be the tax shield, and I use the Greek letter tau to represent, lowercase Greek letter tau, to represent the tax rate. The tax shield is tau times the amount of the interest. So, putting it another way, the cost of debt isn't 20,000. It's 20,000 times 70%, because you're saving $6,000. So it's 20,000 times 1 minus 0.3. The cost of debt wasn't 20,000. It was 14,000. That would be 20,000 times 1 minus your tax rate. That would be 20,000 times 1 minus your tax rate. So if I write that as percentage, if I wrote, and I'll use the letters in the book, the K's, I've finally given up on my little R's. If I said case of D is the market cost of debt for you at any given point in time, recognizing that that would go up as you gather more debt into your capital structure as a percentage, then the after-tax cost of debt, which you would make your decisions on, is 1 minus the before cost of debt times 1 minus tau. If K sub D is the cost of debt to the company at any given point in time, then 1 minus tau times K sub D is the real cost of debt to your firm. Do you understand what this implies? It has huge implications both in business and in consumer finance. Suppose you had two companies. Suppose you had two companies. One was a very large company. One was a very small company. Suppose that the very small company's marginal tax rate is 20% and the very large company's marginal tax rate is 40%, just for simplicity here. Both of the companies can go to the capital markets and get money at 6%. Okay? They can both go out there and borrow at 6% in the capital markets. But, so case of D is 6% in both cases. But for the large corporation, the after-tax cost of debt for the large corporation is 1 minus 0.4 times 6%. For the small corporation, it's 1 minus 0.2 times 6%. So for the small corporation, the after-tax cost of debt is 4.8%. For the large corporation, the after-tax cost of debt for the same debt is 3.6%. If you're not calling bullshit, you should. That is forcing, distorting capital structures. The progressiveness of our corporate tax system distorts the capital structure. It's even more distorted than that, because a large corporation is going to hire a bank of lawyers and accountants that'll find all kinds of different ways to scoot out from taxes, while a small corporation is going to get its ass kicked here. Same cost of capital. The markets are still charging them the same cost. It's just that the tax structure does this. It's the same story with consumer debt, too.
A poor family, a working poor family, could be in, let's say, the 15% marginal tax bracket. And a rich family could, let's say, be in a 38% marginal tax bracket. Both of them want to borrow on a loan, get a loan for a home. Well, the interest on home mortgages is tax deductible. So if both of them go to a bank and get, and that is doing fixed rate 30-year loans at 6.99%, the poor family's after-tax cost of the debt, the real after-tax, the after-tax cost of the debt is 1 minus 0.15 times 6.99%. The rich family has 1 minus 0.38 times 6.99 as their after-tax cost of debt. Same loan, same terms, same value, except that the rich family gets a bigger percentage deal on the interest rate on the loan, thanks to the government and a progressive tax system, which is supposed to help the poor, but it ends up punishing the poor. It distorts. Rich people are more likely to get loans because it is more of a benefit to them. And all the good things that come from owning your own home, like a little bit more protection from obtrusive searches and seizures, like better the chance to build up equity and protect yourself in your old age and all that kind of good stuff, rich family gets more than the poor family does. And if that doesn't piss you off, then you're not a good liberal. Even a good conservative says that's just ridiculous. Okay, enough of that. I've torn my ass on that subject. Here we go. That's debt. Not really hard. I mean, you know, that was all kind of just fluff and stuff. Okay, now let's talk about preferred. Preferred is easy. Preferred is a joke. It's just a rearrangement of that perpetuity formula. It's just the if you could do the algebra of the, remember the perpetuity formula. A constant dividend, the same dividend year over year on a perpetuity. Just rearrange that dividend, and you do have to throw in one extra special little extraordinary thing here. Well, let me do it like this. I'm going to keep it, the example on that board and do it over and do the. I'm going to do the example on this board over here and then just write the formulas on that board over there. Now, the cost of preferred stock, K sub P, is going to be the flat dividend that you get in dollar terms. And remember, that's the dividend percentage that's on the preferred share times the par value of it, divided by the price of the preferred share minus your float. Now the float, that's how much you have to pay the broker-dealer, the lawyers, the promoters, and everyone else on earth when you sell preferred stock. Now, since I got out of the business, I understand that there are caps on how much. In my time, those floats, I mean, we were talking like 20%. Before the company even saw the money from an issue of stock, it had already had a big amount taken out by all these different people being helpful, including me. I tried to get mine, but I never did see mine very often. But here, let me do a simple example of it. 4% DLM preferred. $100 par. Per share. The company is DLM. It's 4% dividend forever and ever and ever. I could even say 4% cumulative, and that'd make it even better. 4% dividend on $100. So that means that this company is going to get $4. If you own a share of preferred of DLM, you will get $4. Every year for the rest of your life. Let's take a float of 6%. Okay? And let's take a price. I think I'm going to take a price of $96. Now, just like debt, well, why isn't this paying? Why isn't the price $100? Well, probably in this case, when it was during the new issue, it came off at 4%, with the coupon's 4%, the dividend's 4%, but the market probably said, you should have given us a little more than 4%, maybe 4.4%, 4.5%. That's why you see this actually performing at a discount to par like a bond would. It's selling at less than $100 simply because it's probably that 4% isn't quite enough for the risk of this preferred. But that's what happens. That's life. So we can honk this thing out, and we can say that the cost of the preferred would be the $4 dividend divided by the price of 96 minus 6% on the $96. And that will come out to be 4.43%. Yeah. Yes, 0.06 times 96. The float we usually say is a percentage of the sale price of the stock. So you could just say, well, why? You could actually technically, I'm going to say just 0.94 times 96 in the denominator. You could do that. One minus 0.06 is 0.94. Just say 0.94 times $96. Come up with the same number in the denominator. I'm just being expansive there. Okay. Nothing big about that. Okay. It's just the cost of preferred. It has a cost. It has a percentage cost. And it's kind of an odd thing because you don't often think about equities having an interest rate. Yeah, it does. Equity does have an interest rate. So now we've got cost of preferred down. Now let's talk about common. We've got internally generated common and externally generated common. Unfortunately, things get a little more complicated here, and in fact, they can actually get to be an awful lot like work. If you have a constant dividend, a constant growth rate model, that one that I showed you before where the dividend grows at a constant rate year after year, you can do this. You can get the cost of capital fairly quickly. No big thing. If you don't have a constant dividend model, you're probably going to go to CAPM. You're going to have to go to the capital asset pricing model to get a case of S. It's just what you'll have to do. You'll have to hope to God that there's a beta that you can work with for it. And of course, there probably will be. If there's not, you can do it yourself. You can actually calculate, work out beta. It's not easy unless you've got the right software, but you can do it. You can get a beta but here what I'm going to write for our purposes for this class, just for the time being anyway, is I'm just going to say, all right, if we have a constant growth rate of the dividend, then it would just be for internally generated equity would be the K sub S, the cost of common internally generated equity that's already outstanding, would be the dividend in the first period divided by the price now, all of that plus the growth rate. Now I caution you, that is the dividend in the first period. DLM just paid a 20¢ per share dividend on its common. Outstanding. Good news.
The current price of a share of DLM is $12, and the dividend, well, the dividend is expected to go at a constant rate from now on of 5%. Now, that's not too bad. At a constant rate of 5% forever. And the current price of DLM common is $12. Here's the little thing that I want to point out, just a side note. Per share, $12 per share, I should say. We're going to use the constant growth rate model. Now, whenever you do numbers, and especially where you start making assumptions, you make sure that you're making assumptions that are reasonable. If you're going to use it, truth be told, I've used this model myself several times. The one problem, of course, is you have to have a dividend-paying stock, and you have to have some justification for saying that there's going to be a more or less constant growth rate of the dividend from here on out. If you can, you justify it in your mind. You don't lie to yourself, but you justify it in your mind. Then if someone comes to you and says, well, how do you know it's going to be 5%? How do you know it's going to be constant? Are you saying it's going to happen that it's going to be constant forever? That's, if you have done your homework and you have a good, valid basis for doing what you're doing, that's when you simply can turn to the person who's challenging your model, your method of getting a price, and say, STFU. Asshole. You see, yeah, you can chop anyone down. It's a matter that really, yeah, we can go to the CAPM and get one, get a cost of internal generated equity. If you don't like the CAPM, you go to grad school and I'll teach you how to do it with stochastic calculus and the Black-Scholes options pricing model. That's when it gets to be a lot like work, and you, no one except airheads like me know how to do this kind of stuff. So unless you really want to go into a league where you're talking actual physics, the same stuff that's done in theoretical and applied physics, then this constant growth rate model and the CAPM are your choices. After that, it gets to be way too weird. Okay, there you go. Let's get this one down. We can say, okay, then in the case that I've given you here of DLM common, the cost of stock, of existing stock outstanding, common stock outstanding, would be D1. Don't put 20 cents. It's one period out. It's 20 cents grown to the next period. Remember, present values telescope back. You've got to get D1, not D0. So when I do this, I would say it would be 20 cents times 1.05. In other words, D0 times 1 plus the growth rate of the dividend to grow it one period, so you got 1, not 0. Make sure you do 1, dividend 1, not dividend 0. I gave you dividend 0. I said they just declared the 20 cent dividend, or they just sent it out, the checks, one another. So you've got to get D1 for the cost of capital. You've got to get D1 for the cost of capital. And so you honk it out, and after you do that, little part on top, on the bottom, you divide it by the price, $12 per share, and then you get that division done, and then you add the growth rate, which is 0.05. And if you work that out, your cost of capital for DLM will be 6.75%, I guess. Is that right? Yeah, 6.75%. Okay, higher cost than the preferred. It comes after preferred. It's a higher risk, higher rate of return.
The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. I think I've heard that somewhere before. Last one. You're selling new stock. You would do it like the existing stock, except you've got to pay the broker fees, the lawyer fees, the promoter fees. So we would do the bottom with the P sub S. In the case of new common equity, we would do D1 over P sub S minus the float costs plus G. D1 over the quantity P sub S, price of the stock minus the float costs. Then all that plus G. So let's take what we had here and say, suppose that we're going to now issue new stock. We're going to issue new stock. Float, just like the preferred, the float is 6% on new issue. So now let's look at what the cost of issuing new common stock would be. It would be pretty much, it's the same model as I did here, except that I've got to deal with that float. So the cost of new equity is going to be the D1, which will again be 20 cents grown one period. So it's 20 cents times 1.05 to get D1. D0 times 1 plus G. And then all that divided, in this case, by $12 minus 6% of $12. That 6% of $12 is what the dogs get to shut them up until you need them again. And then you add your growth rate in. Plus 0.05, was it? And what do you get? 6.86% is the cost of new equity. Higher because you pay points. Just like on a home loan. You pay yourself some points. And so the cost, the actual after the points cost of the debt is a little higher. So notice the chain. It goes, cheapest is debt until you got too much of it. Then it gets expensive. The next cheapest is preferred, but you're married forever to a preferred shareholder. It ain't just like common stock. Once you start issuing preferred stock, you've got to pay that dividend out forever. And you know what? Common stockholders are going to be awfully antsy about that, because that means that I know if you've got preferred stock outstanding, I'm never going to see a dividend unless that daggone preferred stock gets satisfied every last year. So that might not be such a great idea. Then you got your outstanding common stock. Those are your typical shotgun kinds of marriages. You're married to the stock. You can ignore them, but you can't ignore them forever because they'll beat your stock up. Notice something. Watch what happens. Do you see that if you start pissing off your shareholders, the price, they'll sell your stock, your price will go down. What happens to your cost of internally generated equity? As they drop your price of your stock by bailing on you, it drives your cost of internally generated equity up. Okay? So you got to make them happy. But then your most expensive would be your new issue, because that has all the costs of internally generated, plus you had to pay some costs that you get nothing after you've paid those lawyers, after you pay those external accountants, those broker-dealers. There's nothing that comes of that ever again. That's just out the door. So there's your cost, components of the cost structure right there. And on Thursday, we'll do the marginal cost of capital. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.